What do you remember about the Great Depression and how it affected your family and how it affected Melrose Park?
Well, you know, yes, I was in the middle of that, but it didn't bother us too much because we were brought up with not having anything we wanted. In fact, we had an empty lot on each side of the house, and my father said, "We cannot eat grass." We planted tomatoes and peppers and corn, and we had stuff left over for the winter, you know. We kill a pig and make sausages and hang them on bamboo poles on the porch, you know. And then with the fat from the pig, we would put in a big crock, dried, pour the hot fat in there. During the winter, they take some fat, sausage, fry it in the morning and make sandwiches for them, you know. We also had homemade bread. My mother would make the dough, and we'd bring it to neighborhood bakeries that were outside behind their houses. They made it out of brick. It was hearth oven. And some were down the basement in their homes, and they made brick. They made homemade bread, too. And it cost us 5 cents for a loaf. But the loaves were that long, this wide, and so high, nice and crusty. You go home and put some butter on it and eat it right away.
I got to ask you about the pig. did you actually, like, raise pigs yourself?
No, we raised 25 chickens, rabbits, pigeons, and one goat. We had fresh milk. They had kids. When it was time, I'd bring this. Her name was Nellie. I'd bring Nellie to a woman that had a male goat, you know, a billy goat. First time I went there, I says, "How much are you going to charge me to get her impregnated?" She says, $2. She was an Italian woman. I said, $2. I says, "Your goat's going to have the fun, and I got to pay you?" One of the girls that went to school with me, her name was Margaret McKenzie. Her mother was, her grandmother was the one that had the goat. I often tell her about this joke, you know, with the goat. Her property was next to the church's nuns' quarters. Right across the street was her property, right on the sidewalk. Years later, when she died, they pulled it all down and made a parking space out of it. And there, the goat went too.
I imagine you remember where you were when you heard about Pearl Harbor.
I heard about Pearl Harbor in my house, listening to the radio.
That's when they announced it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And so, one of the fellows that lived on 23rd, his name was Frankie Yomini. He was one of the boys that was in the Arizona. Yeah. He had begged his father to go join the Navy. His father didn't want to sign up for him because he was 17 years old. However, he insisted. Father said, "All right, go ahead." It was a bad choice. And his father didn't, I don't think he ever got over it because he felt so bad.
So after the U.S. entered the war, did you end up being drafted or did you volunteer? How did you end up in the Army?
I took my test and I passed it. And they allowed me to stay home a couple of weeks, you know. But really, I was taken with 40 other fellows from Melrose Park. We all left at one time. But yeah. The ones that left before us, they shipped them straight to Europe. Yeah, and a lot of them died. Yeah, we were lucky because we didn't go right away. We were shipped to Seattle, Washington, and Fort Lewis.
Did the town give you a big send-off?
They gave us some coffee and rolls.
You're going off to war and they give you coffee?
That was it. They put us in a bus, and we took off, and we left all the family here.
Oh, okay.
It was in the school on 25th Avenue in Bellwood. That was the central point where everybody was supposed to meet.
So you ended up in Washington State?
Yeah, yeah, and it's a beautiful state. We used to take our exercise in the woods, you know. They're all pine trees. We went down the coast, you know, all the way to Indio, California. Oh, then we had to go from Indio into the desert, 50 miles inland. And there you had scorpions and sidewinders, and you had to put up tents and stuff like that, you know. Well, a week later, they had a sign on the board, "Who wants to go to school?" So I put my name on right away, you know. And they sent me to Fort Knox, Kentucky, to learn truck and tractor mechanic, learned about the motors and the tanks. They had Cadillac engines, two Cadillac engines side by side, one transmission to turn the tractor, you know. So I went back, and they had given me two stripes with a T on it as a technician. And we sort of protected the coast, too, in case the Japanese wanted to attack. We were there. We worked together for about a year, and all of a sudden, they separated us. The married people stayed behind, the single ones, went to Louisiana and learned swamp training with the tanks, you know. Well, I was there maybe 3 or 4 weeks, and I was called that you're going to have to leave the outfit and go to a field artillery because they had tractor-drawn guns, and they need mechanics for that. So five of us, that was in headquarters, and they had A, B, C. We all went to this, 742nd Light Tank Battalion, and with the 771st Field Artillery Battalion. We left and went to Fort Hood, Texas. And within a month, got on a train, went up to New York, Camp Shanks, New York. And from there, we went on a boat and went overseas. It took 13 days to get to the other side.
So this was 1944, I think? 1944, I think. So where in England did you end up landing?
We landed in Liverpool. Then we marched down the street, you know. We were all young guys, like 21, 22 years old. We got to the area where they had these Quonset huts, and that's where we stayed for a whole month. But in the meantime, they allowed us to go fraternize with the people, you know, learn how to eat fish and chips and go to the pubs and drink their...
Warm ale?
Yeah, it was warm. It wasn't cool at all. But it was good. It was a heavy beer, and it was good.
So then you were in England for how long before you shipped out to France?
1 month. Yeah. Because all our equipment is in Cosmoline, which is a grease-type thing to prevent rust, you know. Because you go out in the sea, the salt water rusts.
So you had to clean all that off?
That had to be cleaned off and get set for our trip across the channel.
So how long after D-Day did your unit land in France?
I think it was probably 3 weeks after.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So did you actually land at Normandy, or did you go to one of
the... Well, Utah Beach is Normandy.
Okay.
We didn't have any opposition when we did land. And our job was to get that port abreast clean to stop them from sinking our ships. And from there, we had skirmishes going up to Paris. By the time we got to Paris, they had that under control too.
Okay.
So from Paris, we went to Belgium, and the weather was rainy and muddy. Well, the Germans couldn't come this way, we couldn't go that way with our tanks and tracks, you know. So we stayed there, and our job was to repair 2.5-ton trucks and jeeps and stuff like that. And sometimes they take all the good stuff we had, they give us their junky things, and we have to fix them too. So we were always kept busy. I didn't have to fire any guns, but during the Battle of the Bulge, they gave me a bazooka. And at that time, we couldn't see 5 inches in front of you. The fog was so heavy, and our planes could not see anything to be up there either. So the Germans, being as smart as they are, they attacked because the weather got cold, the mud got frozen, they dressed in white, and they came down the hill and annihilated our infantry. And at the same time, our gunners were told, destroy the breech of your gun. So they put some bombs in each breech, destroyed all our guns. Then they called back and said, take off, because the Germans are right on top of us. So I had a 10-ton wrecker that was me and my friend Ray Sutton. We were in charge of that truck, and it was loaded with gasoline. 5-gallon cans of gasoline, and our tools. So we went cross-country through the fields and cow paths, you know, and we got from the German border all the way to the French border.
How many miles was that? Do you know offhand?
Well, if you look in here, I'll show you.
Okay.
But it was a long way. And when we got there, we had to make slit trenches and keep yourself below surface level of the ground, because if there's a bombing come, shrapnel shoots out, you know, and if you're below, you won't get hurt unless they hit you direct. And so that's what we did for about 3 days. And then I got called by Captain Becker. He said, John, you and I have to go to the front. He took me because I spoke a little German, I understood a little, and he was German and didn't understand none of it, you know. So we jumped in the Jeep and we went cross country to the cow paths again, which was safe, and we got there, miraculously. We'd ask the people that we met, which way are the Germans, you know, they say that way. So we take the other way, you know? So we wouldn't, because the only firearm we had was, he had a pistol and I had a little carbine, you know. So So we got to this, I forget what town it was, probably marked on the map. We went down this basement of this huge house, and they had tanks on each side of the house firing, boom, 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 you know. We had generals and all kinds of brass, you know, figuring out what to do next. And I'm there all by myself, looking to see what I could find in the basement there. Well, I found a bottle of cognac, but luckily I could read Italian, you know. And on there it says cheval, which means for the horse. It was legitimate. I said, shucks. So we did that for about 14 days, going back and forth, you know, from headquarters to the front lines. My clutch went out, and I told the captain about it. He said, yeah, I noticed you can't make a hill anymore. So we went to, he said, we got to go back and have it fixed. So we went back to our unit, and 3 days later, it was fixed and ready to go. The captain said, John, we have to go now. I said, wait a minute, captain. He says, I'm not a Jeep driver. I'm a truck and tractor mechanic. He looked at me, he started laughing. He said, all right, I'll get somebody else. Yeah, he was a nice guy. But it wasn't very much fun in the front line. The snow was this high, and I froze my fingertips. It was very cold. And the Jeep had open top, you know.
Oh, you didn't have the canvas top on?
No.
In the middle of winter.
In the middle of winter, in December. Yeah. Being that you're young, you don't realize how dangerous it is. You don't realize how cold it is.
So after we were able to stop the Germans, what happened then? Did you end up going into Germany or Czechoslovakia?
Well, we when the fog lifted, that's when our planes could come in and destroy these convoys of German equipment. You know, then we could fight back, and naturally we were more Americans than there was Germans. And at that time, a lot of the German youth were put in, you know, 14, 15 years old, and the older ones, 60, 65, you know. So the regular crew was not really there. They were scattered in Russia and Africa, you know. They wore themselves out then with too many fronts, you know. And we went through Luxembourg because they had some trouble in Czechoslovakia. They sent us there to stop the SS troops from needlessly killing the civilians. So we got to this town of Lidovich, our front line cut down the SS troops, and that was the end of the war for us. Yeah. Once the war ended, we came back to Germany, and we were taking care of these concentration camps for a while. Well, we also went to the Dachau camps where the poor Jewish people were held, and they had very poor bedding, you know, made out of planks and stuff like that. And it wasn't a good sight to see. They were maltreated very badly. But I met a lot of the younger German soldiers. They were 13, 14 years old. So after about a month staying in Germany, we also had trips on the side. We went to Berchtesgaden, and we saw where Hitler had his hideout high up in the mountains, a beautiful place. And they had elevators. They went straight down, like 100 feet down from the top of the mountain, going down. And they had hand-operated aerators to put air into the compartments that they were in. So they were well set, you know. So we also had a lot of sightseeing that we could go to different places, because Captain Becker was a pretty nice fellow for that. So I got some pictures here to show you some of the places that I was in.
Okay. You got to see them on Uncle Sam's Dime.
Uncle Sam's what?
Uncle Sam's Dime.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You know what they called the dime? The picture of the person on the dime? They called them the German Eliminator. Something like that. It was Roosevelt, you know?
Right. Okay. Oh, okay.
They called him this is the German Eliminator, because he fought he was the president during the war. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when he died, they announced it over the microphone, and we felt bad about it, but then Truman came in and took over.
After you returned to New York?
We went to New York. We saw the Statue of Liberty. Everybody was happy about that. And from there we went to...
So what was it like coming home then, after all those years?
Well, it was... I had mixed emotions, you know. They sent us all the way to Chicago, and I had my duffel bag with me, and I had to get on the elevator to get home. Nobody picked me up.
So you took the L home from the war?
Yeah. And
how did you get from Oak Park to Melrose Park?
I think
the streetcar?
I think the streetcar still came down Lake Street to 25th Avenue. Okay. So I got off on 24th and walked down two blocks to my home. And at that time, they knew I was coming home, and all my relatives were in the house waiting for me. Nobody thought about coming and helping me carry that big one. And it was a nice get-together again. Yeah.